Coming up, we find out the secrets of scaling in embryos.
Different size tissue produces larger or smaller segments, and these correlations are linearly proportional.
And we taste wine with a hint of drought.
If we came back in 50 years' time and tried the 2058 version of this wine, we might expect it to be quite different. And they might have replanted with other grapes that are better suited to the hotter, drier climate that they'd be experiencing.
Plus, we look back at the biggest science stories this year. This is the Nature Podcast. I'm Kerry Smith.
And I'm Jeff Brumfield.
It's nearly Christmas, and if yours is anything like mine, you might be looking for a nice bottle of wine to go with your meal on Christmas Day. Yes, I know, the Nature Podcast wouldn't usually be your go-to for wine know-how, but this week is different. Self-titled wine anorak Jamie Good has come into the studio to talk about the science of wine, and more specifically, how winemaking is being affected by climate change. He's written a comment piece about this for Nature this week, and luckily for us, he's brought with him some samples. Hi, Jamie.
Hi there.
Now, before we open anything, perhaps you should just tell us what kind of parameters of wine growing can be affected by climate.
Yeah, good question, because the thing about wine is that it's just so incredibly diverse. It's very complicated, largely because the environment really shapes and determines which grape varieties you can grow where. And there are about 1,400 different grape varieties grown commercially worldwide. And each of these grape varieties is very, very fussy about where it grows. A small swing in temperature either way can mean that that grape variety doesn't produce decent wine anymore. And so this is why the wine industry has been so interested in climate change, which has big commercial implications.
Yeah, I mean, in this comment piece, you've actually described it as a canary sort of in the coal mine, as it were, for climate change, right?
Yeah, that's because of this exquisite climatic sensitivity of grapevines.
So there have been some studies showing how climate might affect wine. Can you tell us a little about those?
Yeah, the most famous one is by a guy at Oregon State University called Gregory Jones. And him and his team basically have looked back using climate records over the last 50 years through all the major wine regions in the world to see how much average temperatures have increased. And then they've used some very powerful climate prediction tools to look and see how they think the climate might change over the next 50 years. And this has caused a lot of interest in the wine world, because the answer is it's not really good news. It's for most people, they're going to lose out with the sorts of climatic shifts that are predicted.
So here in the UK, of course, we've got slightly the opposite going on, because there are quite a few vineyards now sprouting up in at least the south of the country. But perhaps we should stick with your negative example for our first tasting, because this is from Australia, a region that's predicted to suffer under climate change.
Yeah, well, Australia's actually got quite a lot of different wine regions, so it's not quite as simple a story as that. There are lots of cool climate regions in Australia that are currently a source of a lot of interest. But it's a lot of the traditional areas are really quite warm climate areas, and they're suffering a double whammy. First of all, the increased temperatures are hitting the grape quality. And secondly, the availability of water is a huge issue, because a lot of these areas rely on irrigation.
So tell us a little bit about the wine you've brought then from Australia.
Well, it's quite a nice wine. It's Yulumba, the signature Cabernet Sauvignon Shiraz blend. They're the grape varieties. And this is about £30 a bottle, so this is quite high end. And it's from the Barossa Valley, which is, you know, the most traditional and historic of Australia's wine-growing regions. And the Barossa makes very ripe, rich red wines, and they're quite delicious. But if it gets any hotter there, then I think that wine quality will certainly suffer quite a bit. And we'll have a taste of this.
Yeah.
I'm struggling with the corkscrew here. The warmer the climate gets, the richer and riper and fuller the wine style is. There you go.
Thank you.
So we should cheers here.
Yes.
Mm.
Kind of podcast I like.
Gosh, you can already smell it.
Mm. Give myself a second taste.
Yes.
There.
What do you think of it?
So the first thing I notice is it smells very much grape. You can smell the grape in it. And then when I taste it, it tastes very rich, I think, as you said. Mm. It's got a very deep sort of flavor to it. Quite mellow, actually, in a way.
You know, I struggle with some of the French reds sometimes, because they're quite subtle, what's going on, whereas this I wouldn't describe as... Subtle doesn't seem particularly the right word for it.
It's rich, it's bold, it's quite high in alcohol, 14.5%, but it's got a nice texture to it. It's a nice sweetness. It's a dry wine, but the fruit profile is quite sweet, which I think is very attractive. And I think this is, when I first got into wine, this is the sort of wine I just really loved.
So, I mean, how would you expect this wine then to change as the climate starts to warm?
Well, if Greg Jones and his team, if their predictions are right, if we came back in 50 years' time and tried the 2058 version of this wine, we might expect it to be quite different. If the average temperatures in the Barossa rise by 2 degrees in that 50-year period, then I think what we'll find is that those grapes, Cabernet Sauvignon, Shiraz, may no longer be suitable for that region. And they might have replanted with other grapes that are better suited to the hotter, drier climate that they'd be experiencing.
But replanting isn't just as simple as you stick the vines in the ground and the next year you do something with them, is it? You've got to prepare quite a long time in advance.
This is a big problem. So, for instance, if you were to take a vineyard and you say, right, we're going to replant it, you'd rip the old vines out and put new vines in the ground. You'd have to wait 3 years for the first vintage, for the first crop. And then you'd probably have to wait another 10 years for the vines really to hit their stride and produce top-quality wine. So it's a big commitment.
I suppose, I mean, one thing I wonder about is the uncertainty of climate change, because there still is a lot of uncertainty. I mean, it doesn't seem obvious there's a right course of action for every vineyard out there, especially on the scale of individual regions. We don't know exactly what will happen, right?
Absolutely. And one of the problems is that, for instance, in the Napa Valley, they're actually getting a little bit cooler because it's changing the way that the coastal fogs get sucked into the valley, which changes the average temperatures. So it's not quite as simple as just everywhere is going to get warmer. And the other big problem for people who've got vineyards is that it's the you know, what you want if you've got a vineyard is you want nice predictable temperatures. You'd be able to predict that it's going to be like this temperature, and then you don't want sudden very cold periods because you might get frost problems then, and you don't want big rainfall events at the wrong time of year. That can cause problems as well. What you want is nice predictable weather. And if, say, for instance, you have one very cold year followed by a very hot year, there's nothing you can do to plan for that.
But I guess, I mean, there is sort of a flip side to this. There are winners and losers in the climate change game. And so you've also brought a region that we're expecting might do a little better. Is that right?
Yeah. This next wine is a German Riesling from Ernst Losen in the Moselle in Germany. You know, Germany so far has been a winner. I mean, in the past, in the 80s, for instance, you used to get 7 good vintages and 3 bad ones in a decade. Now they're getting good vintages every year where they can get the grapes ripe enough to produce a nice wine. So let's try this one. 2011 vintage. And it's just 8.5% alcohol. So this is quite a cool region.
Gosh, that's very different, isn't it? It smells quite flowery.
Hmm.
And is it me, or has it got a little tiny bit of sparkle to it?
It's a little bit of spritz, yeah, a little bit of carbon dioxide. And that kind of helps to keep it fresh in the mouth.
And fruity seems the wrong word, having just described the last one as very red and kind of bold. But in an entirely different way, this one also has kind of almost like elderflowery qualities.
Yes,
to it.
Yes, it definitely has a bit of elderflowery character and maybe a bit of pear, a bit of citrusy, sort of lemony.
Summer in a glass here in the cold winter of the Nature Podcast studio. I heard that there are producers who normally work in the Champagne region of France who've been buying up land in the UK. Is that a vicious rumour?
It's been rumoured, but the problem is the Champagne guys, even if they like the English vineyards, they couldn't make Champagne out of them because Champagne is geographically limited to the Champagne region. So they have very little incentive for doing that.
Looking forward here, I mean, what do you think climate change is going to mean for the wine industry globally? I mean, obviously a lot of disruption, but in terms of the wines, is it going to be good, bad, or just different?
I think a lot of the impact's going to be negative, which is a real shame. Because we've grown to love our classic wines from the classic regions. And, you know, wine's already complicated enough. And I think adding this into the mix just makes it a whole lot more complicated and more difficult for people to get their heads around, which is a real shame.
We might worry about the future of the wine industry, but for the moment, at least for the next few minutes, we're going to enjoy our glasses. Jamie, thank you for coming in.
Thank you. Cheers.
Still to come in the research highlights, the benefits for birds that flock together, and antibiotic resistance running in rivers in China. But first, most of us are looking forward to the holidays, and many of us will undoubtedly overindulge on food. Lucky for you, this is a podcast, so you can't see which bits of us are growing more than others over the holidays. Jokes aside, keeping everything in proportion is a problem for developing organisms, too.
Early embryos grow in segments, and these have to maintain steady proportions despite the fact that the whole thing is constantly growing. This phenomenon is known as scaling. We already knew that a handful of celebrity signaling molecules blink on and off at different times in early cells of the developing embryo, and that scaling is probably controlled by these waves of activity. But seeing the wood for the trees in a real-life organism is a big ask. Alexander Alela and his team have got around this problem by creating a simplified model using immature mouse cells on a petri dish. In this controlled model, they've been able to accurately quantify the activity patterns of some of the important genes, and thus unravel some of the fundamental secrets of scaling. Beautifully proportioned, Jeff Marsh got in touch with Alexander to learn more.
So one of the fundamental problems that an embryo is facing is that it has to keep proportions while it is growing. And that's a process called scaling that has been addressed in many organisms. And the mechanism of how this is achieved is target of our study.
So all the segments sort of stay in proportion. How is that different to it all just kind of growing at the same rate?
Well, one key distinction is that body segment formation is a sequential process. That means you make the first body segment before actually the final total size of the embryo is achieved. And that poses an immense problem because you have to somehow scale and proportionate your segments before the total size is actually determined.
And how did we suppose this was orchestrated then up until now?
So what we do know is that the process of body segment formation involves several signaling pathways. And in mammals, for instance, it has been shown that several of these pathways oscillate in time. So that has been clearly implicated in the last 10 years or so. And these oscillations of notch, wind, and FGF signaling have been implicated in the temporal control of segment formation. This is what has been termed the segmentation clock. But there was no kind of connection to the potential to scale to the overall embryonic size.
Okay, and you addressed that then by creating this sort of 2D model of a developing vertebrate embryo. Tell me about that.
Yeah, that's correct. So we made use of a novel assay that we developed. And in this assay, we use mesoderm cells derived from mouse embryos, and we plate them in petri dishes. And what we found was that this assay actually recapitulates not only the oscillations in the signaling pathway, but also it recapitulates segment formation and also scaling. That means that different sized tissue produces larger or smaller segments, and these correlations are linearly proportional.
So that's amazing. In your very simplified kind of 2D model, scaling still persists.
That's correct. And that gave us a way into the problem of how are these dynamic changes in gene activity actually related to the observation of scaling.
So that's excellent. One of the big successes of your study is that you have this fully functioning model. But you went a step further and you actually went and had a look at some of the quantitative parameters of that. What did you find about what underlies scaling?
So what we found is that if you consider this tissue to be composed of many oscillators and oscillatory units, what we found is that a key parameter is to consider the distribution in activities, if you wish, the distribution in what we call the phases. And these phases are very gradually and spatially distributed, and that creates an ordered sequence of oscillators and activities. This is what we call the phase gradient.
So phase gradient is what informs the cells of size.
That's exactly correct. So we don't address in this work how cells can read out the phase gradient. That's, of course, an open question that is coming out from this work. But what our work is showing is that there is a level of information at this level of phase gradient that is telling the cells how big they make their structures.
And just to be absolutely clear, the phase gradient is the kind of difference in the timing of gene activity.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to say it. It's about the difference, actually. It's not about the absolute time.
And what do you think is the real-world kind of application of this? Or is it completely pure developmental biology?
It is, of course, pure developmental biology. But the more general question is, how do you encode information? At which level is information encoded? And here we are saying that one critical level is actually not the strength of a signal or the distribution of a signal. The information lies within the dynamics of a system. And this is a level that we want to pay attention to more and more in future studies.
And presumably the model that you've developed will help in doing that.
That's correct. So we developed a model that allowed us to ask if the findings and the principles that we measured are sufficient to explain the outcome. And it will prime our future studies to directly ask what molecular machinery is actually underlying these findings.
Alexander Alela talking to Jeff Marsh. Now it's time for the best science outside of nature this week. Here's Thea Cunningham.
Birds of a feather flock together, but so do those from different species. These mixed flocks are puzzling because usually you'd expect competition between similar species for food. But a team from the Indian Institute of Science in Bangalore find that the more similar two birds are, the more likely they are to be found together. The team suggests that the benefits of cooperation, alarm calls and discovering food, for example, outweigh having to share your dinner. That paper is in the American Naturalist. Antibiotic resistance could be running in the rivers in China, reports a team from a risk assessment lab there. Researchers fished microbes out of six rivers in China, and in all six found fragments of synthetic genes, including a gene called beta-lactam antibiotic, which confers resistance to ampicillin. This DNA had been made in a lab. The lab waste could be a source of antibiotic resistance in humans and animals, the team warns. Find that report in the journal Environmental Science and Technology.
As is the custom at this time of year, the Features team has been busy nominating and writing about their top 10 faces of science this year, people who've mattered in science, and Features editor Helen Pearson joins me to talk about them. Hi, Helen.
Hi.
Now, nobody will be very surprised by the first story you focus on. You've chosen the Director General of the organisation responsible for this.
They have a signal around 125 gigaelectron volts of a new particle. This particle very likely could turn out to be the Higgs, or the thing that does what the Higgs does.
That was Jeff Brumfield reporting on the Higgs in July this year. Of course, there are thousands of scientists involved in that story, Helen. Who did you choose and why?
We decided to choose Rolf Hoyer, who's the Director General of CERN, which is the Particle Physics Laboratory in Switzerland, where the discovery was made. Hoyer has budgetary control over the Large Hadron Collider, which generated the Higgs by smashing together protons at very high energies. So there are two experiments that detected the particle and the debris of the collisions at the LHC, and they are run democratically by thousands of physicists. And what happened was, in June, the two leaders of these teams told Hoyer that they had these tantalising results. They had signals of the kind of particle which, you know, seemed to fit what theorists were thinking about the Higgs. But they were understandably very cautious. They wanted to see the statistical error on these measurements get whittled down even further to be sure that they were right. So they really wanted to delay making the announcement. But Hoyer was also under pressure from CERN's governing council to make some kind of announcement of what had been found. And in the end, he made the call. There was going to be a public seminar on the 4th of July, and he decided that even if the two scientists leading these two key teams weren't willing to say they discovered the Higgs, that he could. So they had the seminar, all the press were there, the scientists were there, the scientists laid out the evidence. But at the very end of this, it was Hoyer who stood up and said, "I would now say I think we have it. Do you agree?" And the audience burst into applause, and that was really how the discovery was announced.
So sticking with big physics, but moving to space for the next newsmaker. It was called the 7 Minutes of Terror, but the Curiosity rover made it safely to Mars and onto the surface of the red planet. Here's news editor Ivan Semenek, who went to the landing in August.
It was an incredible system and something that had not yet been tried before on Mars. It was devised in order to bring down a much heavier payload than before. The mass of the rover is about 900 kilos. So including the parachute and this descent stage, firing rockets and then hovering above the surface, and then cables gradually lowering the rover down to the ground, it just seemed like there were so many things that could go wrong. It's been described as a kind of Rube Goldberg contraption.
I just love this story. It sounds so sci-fi. One of our newsmakers was instrumental to this. And Helen, again, hard to pick out just one member of the crew responsible for the rover's entry, descent and parachute-y, sky crane-y landing. But their leader is Adam Steltzner.
That's right. We really thought that this 7 minutes of terror kind of symbolised the drama of the moment with the rover touching down. So he was the engineer who led the entry, descent and landing team, the team that designed this complicated looking apparatus that got the rover down safely. And he is also quite a character. He has a real rockabilly look to him. He became reasonably famous through, all the press that surrounded the touchdown as well. So the whole thing hinged on this unlikely looking sky crane. It lowered the rover to Mars. He talked to us about how he was feeling during this whole process. At one point, everything looked bad. The data was saying catastrophic. It's not going to work. And then he really waited until the very end where he had all the signals come in that not only had the rover touched down, but the sky crane hadn't crashed down onto the rover. And then he gave a nod to the head of the team to say, yes, it's there.
Wow. And I love how the piece says he actually still talks about this in the present tense. I think it's still very much with him.
It certainly seems that way, yes. I mean, reading what our reporter found, you certainly feel like you're back in the moment or back in the 7 minutes.
All right. And moving on, this news chat with Mark Peplow from just November is pertinent to our next science figurehead.
One might even say it's the perfect storm of different factors that have come together to make this so large. And that's why it's so devastating, because, even 280 kilometres from the centre of the storm, when it hit the coast, there were hurricane force winds of more than 120 kilometres an hour. And it's because it has such a huge area as it's sweeping now across the US that it's leaving such a trail of damage behind it.
That was, of course, a report on Hurricane Sandy and its devastation. And Helen, you've chosen climate scientist Cynthia Rosenzweig to represent this story.
That's right, we did. Obviously, Superstorm Sandy was another major news event of this year, and the terrible destruction it caused on the East Coast, and particularly in New York, where it flooded transport tunnels, it destroyed homes, it cut power to millions. And we chose Rosenzweig because she had actually forecast the consequences of exactly such a storm over a decade ago. So she's been involved in assessing the impacts of climate change on the northeast of the states for years. And actually, interestingly, because of that, New York has incorporated climate change adaptation into its planning, such as changing building codes and managing parks and wetlands to accommodate flooding and sea level rise. And actually, that's made the city a leader in preparing for climate change and its consequences. Now she says that the city obviously has a very long way to go to prepare for future events, which could potentially come more frequently in a warmer world.
But without Rosenzweig and the work of people who do what she does, it could have been actually a lot worse in New York.
It was obviously devastating, and we can't pretend otherwise, but potentially it could have been worse, yeah.
Trying to predict events, of course, is something scientists don't like doing very much, and this was thrown into sharp relief by the outcome of a court case this year, which makes the focus of another story, in which another of our newsmakers was indicted. Helen, who was that?
This is Bernardo de Bernardinis. So this is a fascinating story this year, which really came to a climax. He is one of seven people convicted for his part in the L'Aquila earthquake in Italy, which was in 2009, which tragically killed over 300 people. So the story really started a few days before the quake, when he and six of the country's seismic experts participated in a meeting of Italy's major risk commission to assess whether a serious quake might be imminent, because there had been a lot of shocks and going on beforehand and people were nervous. And in a now famous TV interview shortly before this meeting, de Bernardinis said that the situation appeared to be favourable. He suggested that a series of minor shocks that had been going on were actually linked to a continuous discharge of energy. And he famously suggested that people go and have a glass of wine.
La comunità scientifica mi continua a confermare che anzi è una situazione favorevole.
The scientific community continues to confirm that the situation is favourable because there is an ongoing discharge of energy. There are events that are intense, but not too intense, so we have seen little damage considering the long time sequence. Thus, I think we are ready to face the situation. I ask the inhabitants to bear with us. Have a glass of Montepulciano.
So the prosecutors in the case argued that these messages falsely reassured the local population, and so that they stayed inside when they might have left their houses. Then the quake hit, And so as a result, these scientists and De Bernardinis were taken to court and found guilty this year. So a lot of the anger about this was directed at Bernardinis because he was the only government official on this risk commission, on the committee. The rest were scientists, and because of what he had said in this interview. Now, he says he is innocent, and he simply repeated concepts that the scientists had told him. And the case is going to appeal now, so it's certainly not settled. And, you know, one reason all this attracted attention when this verdict came down was just the sort of broader implications, these concerns that because of this, scientists in other situations will be very scared to offer their expert advice because they might be held liable for what they've said about earthquakes or other natural disasters or climate-related events.
All right, so that's Bernardo De Bernardinis there and the six other seismologists found guilty of manslaughter going to appeal. Helen, give us a flavour of the other stories that people will find in this section, because you have 10 newsmakers in total.
Sure, the six we haven't talked about touch on all kinds of other issues which have been in the news this year. We're looking at the issues of replication and sloppy science, which have been very big. We're looking at developments in the stem cell community. We looked at the huge story, of course, about the engineering of a mutant form of H5N1 that could pass between mammals. Also, the progression of women in science, the explosion in genomic sequencing, and also the real rise in interest in open access publishing and new visions of the way publishing could work.
All right, Helen Pearson, Features Editor, thank you very much for coming in. More details on all of those can be found at nature.com/news.
Now, we know you've tried to listen to every Nature podcast this year, but you've probably missed one or two. So as a sort of end-of-year treat, we've decided to condense all our interviews into a single one. Do not adjust your set. This has involved some heavy editing.
This valley, we feel like, is a small-scale version of what's happening across the entire
Fertile Crescent, that is the arc of land that stretches from Israel in the west, north and across
Tajikistan, where they had to eat the sheep's head.
Okay, so what did that lead you to ask?
So the big question that we have right now, or the sort of very active question we are studying, is
why we assemble ourselves into these elaborate, intricate patterns.
We're halfway through the fourth week. And so far, we found 5 ancient shipwrecks.
What did you find on these boats then? And then what did you do?
Predominantly just milk and seaweed that we steep overnight and then sort of blend them together and then freeze.
Milk and seaweed, huh?
It was thought that it was a spontaneous hybrid between
Barack Obama and Mitt Romney.
We chose them because they're both widely used pesticides in the UK, but also because they have different modes of action. So
if a person gets a dose, they can't see anything, they can't taste anything, nothing crawls out of the jar, it's just microscopic eggs.
Right. So, what do these eggs look like?
They are tiny little flakes, and they're blunted on one side and sharp on the other, and we know that they were inserted
into northern Iran.
Sounds sexy.
Well, it is sexy, and that's what's kept it alive for so long with so much funding, because, you know, people give these great PowerPoint briefings.
Besides all the sex they were having.
Essentially, you're looking for a change that must have happened after
8 years of the George W. Bush administration, where there had been a kind of buildup of
plaques of something called amyloid beta.
Can you use that for anything? What can you now try to do?
Let's put it this way. I'm very optimistic about what we could do.
With meter-thick slabs of pure water ice.
Of course, you've sacrificed your ability to climb trees, but
this tree doesn't tell us really anything very new about the relationship of sparrows to ostriches.
I think that's all my questions. Will you be my friend on Facebook?
I don't think this is ever going to happen.
That's it from us this year. Join us again on the 10th of January when we'll reveal the biggest risks you've never heard of. I'm Kerry Smith.
And I'm Jeff Brumfield. Happy holidays!